Thank you. I'd like to move on to, I'm conscious that we could talk about MTD all day, but I'd like to move on to the second area I wanted to pick up on, which is the whole concept of sort of policy and legislative challenges and changes. Stella, perhaps I can start with you. I mean, obviously MTD was just one of more than 500 pages of legislation that was dropped from the pre-election finance bill. What do you think should happen after the election? Do you want to see it all come back? Should some of the post-election legislation be given retrospective effect? I mean, you know, should we go back to the start of the year for such things as changes to loss relief, interest deductibility, deemed domicile, or should those sorts of proposals actually have their commencement delayed?
So, for me, I think there's two key points I would kind of address, and I'm assuming that most people are going to be pretty consistent on this one. I think what's most important is to get the legislation right. The debate that we could have about some of the provisions that have been deferred are pretty much consistent with the debate we've just had about MTD. I think most of them are coming, so we could argue that they should be deferred or taken away and re-evaluated. I think that's probably fair, but if we're kidding ourselves that they're not going to come into the legislation, then that's exactly what we're doing. We're kidding ourselves. So I think it's most important to get it right. So I would recommend that we try and defer the implementation of it and have proper debate, as is advocated in Jill's and the CRT's report. The other thing I would say, though, is that, again, as with all of these things, one of the biggest issues that businesses have and all taxpayers is the lack of certainty. So one of the biggest problems is if we don't know, once we get the new government, what they're going to do, if they make us hang around in limbo yet longer. You know, most of us are probably operating on the basis that these provisions will come in, and they will come in with the effective date that we've been assuming until the election was called. So it would be good to get some real clarity on that sooner rather than later. Either tell us that we're going to defer it and have a proper debate and have a chance to get the legislation right, because the legislation is not right at the moment, or tell us that we're going to have to go with the date and let's just get on and deal with it.
So, Paul, what sort of advice are you giving your clients about, you know, the stuff that was dropped from the finance bill and might come back?
Don't think it's gone away, because it hasn't. It's coming back and there'll be more where that came from.
I'm afraid I think that's right. John, I'm conscious that when the finance bill was published and you saw it, you said, you know, it was the longest ever, and you expressed the hope that this would be, quote, the last hurrah for tax policy proliferation. How hopeful are you now?
Well, one tries to be optimistic. I think when you look at the provisions in the longest finance bill in history, an awful lot of them were to do with proposals that had been pretty fully developed or at least the direction of them laid down in stone, as it were, by the previous chancellor. And I think there was an element of, you know, trying to be nice to the new chancellor and hoping he'd be enlightened and do things in a different way from many of his predecessors. And I guess the jury is still out. You know, there is the move to the single fiscal event, which is a very good one. Perhaps the broader message of the Better Budgets report, that you ought to be very consultative, you know, from the first stage, was not taken up, and that led to a bit of a debacle with the national insurance provisions in the budget. I think it's really becoming clear that this whole approach of springing surprises in a budget is just past its sell-by date, and it puzzles me that chancellors continue to believe it's to their net political advantage, because it doesn't matter how reasoned you are in the budget speech, if the first time that anybody is going to pay a bit more tax hears about it is on News at 10 that night, and it's already presented as a done deal. It kind of requires an almost superhuman effort, however great the imbalances of the tax system, or however strong the intellectual case, to expect people to react positively to that. Whereas, I think people can be brought to understand difficult messages if there is enough preparation and the alternatives are considered and debated and presented sufficiently. So I don't know, really, in truth, I would be hopeful that maybe that penny will begin to drop.
I mean, Jill, you together with John were obviously co-author of that Better Budget report to which he refers, which was produced by the IFG, the CIOT, and the IFS. I mean, the report was very warmly received by government. What do you think the real prospects are of better policy making in the light of that report's recommendations?
Well, my analysis is very similar. It won't be that surprising to you. To John, I mean, I think the move to a single fiscal event is positive, not least because that reduces the pressure to produce things to say, which seems to be, you know, just filling the space available seems to be one of the pressures for budget hyperactivism. I think it would be really good if whichever government comes back does think we now have a 4 to 5 year term, question mark, do they repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, but we're now here for a duration. We actually need to make the UK look like an attractive economy, being an economy where, you know, the IMF called us out for how often we change the tax system, how confusing that is for taxpayers, how difficult it is for people to plan, isn't a part of making Britain sort of fit and attractive place to do business post-Brexit. So I would have thought that hopefully whoever becomes Chancellor might think there's a good case for adopting another of our principles, which was to adopt a more strategic approach at the start of a parliament, to actually work with interested parties to set out roadmaps for reform. One of the problems in the NIC change was that the government had sort of idiotically given away the benefit and then sort of, you know, said, but actually we sort of changed these things. We gave you some benefits on this. Now we're going to make you pay for them. But that sort of timing effect actually loses the capability of saying, actually, we're changing this side of the equation and we're changing this side of the equation at the same time as a package. It was a real tragedy that the Treasury accelerated the NIC changes into this budget rather than wait until the autumn. I mean, you know, a real marshmallow test failure there. They should have waited until after they had the Taylor review. That was a sensible time to go back to NICs. They wouldn't have actually lost any revenue for that. They'd have just had a bit of a scoring gap in this budget. So I think, you know, whatever. The good things that I do think about Philip Hammond, and Jane Ellison said that when she came to our Better Budgets launch, was actually this Chancellor doesn't seem as compelled as his predecessors to make the budget speech a de facto State of the Union speech, which covers every issue going. And actually, there were a lot fewer measures in this March budget, and hopefully he'll stick to that in the autumn budget and have a lot fewer measures, because actually government's got loads of other things to be doing at the moment. The big loss, I think, on the scrutiny side, though, is the loss of Andrew Tyrwhitt from the Treasury Select Committee. And I think Andrew has actually was very helpful on the Better Budgets report in suggesting things. And I think that that is a shame, because actually he was, you know, harrying the Treasury on making tax digital and other things. And I think it will be, you know, difficult for replacement to come up to speed quickly enough on these issues.
So just to come back to you again, I mean, we've been talking about tax simplification for years, you know, both John and Paul Morton, his successor. But one of the problems, as I said in the speech I gave at the AGM, is that, you know, governments has already decided that certain topics are just too politically difficult and they can't address them. And I just wonder whether you think there is any evidence that actually the public might be prepared to talk about some of these much more radical proposals if only they were explained to them properly.
Is that a nice segue into our citizens' jury?
Well, only because the result that really interested me.
Before I get onto the citizens' juries, I would kind of echo again. I think we've been grappling with this generally, and I think Brexit is a perfect opportunity and a worst opportunity. So in some ways, it's a great opportunity to clear the decks, start again, and simplify the tax system. In other ways, it's a terrible time because we're going to have so many other things that the legislature have to deal with that actually tax reform is going to be so way down the list that we're probably never going to get there. But in terms of engagement, I think absolutely yes. So I think, you know, we see, you know, Vanessa will know better than most, how interested people are in tax. And we'll see over the course of the next few weeks as the manifesto kind of discussions start playing out. And already today, Jeremy Corbyn was raising the profile of tax yet again in terms of the politics and where people go. Our citizens' juries were a way of trying to engage with the public, so not tax professionals, not anybody that actually understood how tax works at all, to try and influence the debate in a slightly different way, just to get some views. So we got 25 people off the street, effectively, to come in and embed themselves in how tax works for 2 days, and they actually enjoyed it. And at the end of that, we asked them lots of questions about, effectively, if you were Chancellor, what would you do? And we explained how trade-offs work and things like that, and people get it, and they get it straight away, and they get very passionate about it. And as a consequence, it's basically became the bedrock of our campaign, of looking at how what tax means, where tax policy goes, and what we need to do and kind of influence that debate. And we continue to do that. So yes, people are very interested and way more engaged than we give them credit for and way more informed than we give them credit for. So they don't need much to kind of help them on their way to kind of be a valid part of the debate that we're having, and we should do more of it.
Vanessa, would you agree with that from sort of your perspective? Do you think people are more engaged with tax than necessarily the government gives them credit for? And will one finance bill rather than two make a significant difference?
It's very interesting. I mean, the behavioural psychologists sort of say that tax is just a very toxic term, and people often behave quite irrationally. You know, they travel distances to avoid a tax cost, and far more so than if it was an ordinary type of cost. And yet, as Ella says, you know, you're faced, if you have to grapple with the issues, you'll actually come up with quite sophisticated understanding of it. So I hope so, but I don't think so. But we will see. We will see. And whether the fiscal event makes a big difference, it's got to be. For all the reasons that John and Jill said, it's, you know, got to push things in the right direction. There'll be a longer debate. We won't have this crazy thing where, you know, we have a budget and then the legislation comes in, you know, sort of weeks later. So that's good. I mean, of course, as a journalist, I'm terribly sad about it. Because, you know,
the only opposition to this came from the Financial Times, as we said. So.
Yeah, I don't think you want to run the country and what's good for journalism, because particularly we like the U-turns and the mere fact that it all goes horribly wrong adds to the gaiety of, you know, sort of writing about it, and clearly that's not a good thing. So, yes, things will be better if Hammond sticks with it, assuming he's the person in charge, and you know, there's good reason to think that he might. I always remember at this point that he'd... back when he was Shadow Chief Secretary, back in 2010, you know, he said he wanted to make budgets so boring that nobody would even want to know the date. And I suspect that may come true.
Let me open that up to the floor. Comments from questions from anybody on the floor. Here, please.
Hello, I'm Natalie Miller. My question, it's inevitable, I suppose, with politics or with any large organisation, that it's always far more exciting to have the latest big thing to think about. But I wonder whether the panel thought it would be more useful to have more big policies or more review and correction of existing policies.
Interesting question. Anybody else? I'm sorry, the lights are so bright, I can't see who everybody is, so I apologise if I don't recognise you.
Kevin Slevin, I'm just wondering about your citizens' jury. Did you not make a mistake? Should you not have grabbed 630 MPs, locked them in a room for 2 days and taught them a little bit about tax?
Too deeply cynical before we've started.
Well,
I can make so many sarcastic comments about that, but it's a very fair question.
Leading on to a more serious point, can we trust Parliament? I'm not trying to offend anyone here. Can we trust Parliament? Is it not too important to leave these matters to Parliament? And should we not have a tax commission set up to examine, for example, this fuss about self-employed status and worker status and employee status? Why not tax all income as income, end of? Why not levy national insurance on all income, end of? Why worry about different classes? It would simplify things. Some of the MPs might even be able to understand half of it if we did it like that.
Okay, thank you. Jill, I mean, basically the question, is tax too important to be left to politicians?
I'm going to say no and yes. Very good civil servicey answer. I think that it's a real shame that the Treasury has not followed the example of other jurisdictions, New Zealand, Australia, and actually commissioned more independent reviews of elements of the tax system. I think it's a huge shame that if you look at Matthew Taylor's terms of reference on the, you know, whatever. They didn't include tax, I mean, which is barking, frankly, and it's just because the Treasury is so proprietorial about tax. I mean, the Treasury really says, mitts off, it's our business, we don't want anything else. So it's very frustrating if you're within government, not in Treasury. It's very frustrating from outside. So I think there should be far more willingness to have independent reviews and discussions then. And some of those techniques, in Australia they use it quite a lot, some of those people actually engage in deliberative techniques to do things. They did that with the Turner Commission on Pensions, which, as James Purnell said, an Institute for Government Study on that, took the issue of raising the state pension age, open brackets, for men, not for women, seemed to politicians be prepared to do it for women, but for men, from sort of, you know, front page news to page 3 to page 56, and just everybody said, now we give it to John Cridland. I mean, so anyway. So I think there's a really good case for actually having far more independent, genuine reviews of bits of the tax system to actually, is it sensible, does this work? Now, the Treasury, to be fair to them, is using the Office of Tax Simplification. Paul's over there, John Whiting is somewhere else around, and John would have said these, as a sort of bit of a stalking horse for doing those things. But still, that's not quite the same sort of process as a sort of independent commission looking at things, taking evidence and having sort of big public engagement. Though people in our report said the OTS was much better at proactive consultation than HMRC was. So I think you should do that. Do you, at the end of the day, take tax as an issue away from Parliament? I think that really would be a huge coup. I mean, that is, you know, Parliament does tax very badly, it does spending incredibly badly, actually. It's, you know, rubbish at both. It doesn't go back and look at the effects of tax policies it enacts, it barely scrutinises tax policies. So it ought to up its game on both spending and on tax. But ultimately, I don't really want, you know, Robert Choate, Mark Carney, Tom Scholar, Ed Troop to set our tax policy. Ultimately, we do need accountable politicians doing that, because these are big political choices, but they need to be informed by much better public debate and much more genuine independent scrutiny, whatever. So that's how I would square your circle. And I think some good big reforms, yes, and actually going back and looking at changes made, saying, is that working as we're intending? Is that having the right effect? Do we leave, do we adjust, or whatever, you know, in a much more systematic way would be a big improvement.
And John, I mean, on this question of sort of, should we, rather than sort of playing around with small policy, should we talk about big policy? I mean, you know, we've talked about the fact that, you know, the government has already decided that certain things the OTS shouldn't look at because they're sort of politically unacceptable. You know, do you think there is scope to say, well, we ought to be looking at really fundamental reforms, like a major change to the VAT system? You know, should we abolish inheritance tax and introduce capital gains tax on death? I'm not saying those policies, but something of that sort of scale, even though it might be politically toxic.
Well, if you go back to 2010, I think, when it was rumoured there was going to be a major increase in VAT, the IFS was sort of floating, you know, imposing VAT on food, which I think at that time would have raised the equivalent of, you know, the 2.5% rise. And, you know, if you think about it, we've got a problem of obesity. About a third of the food is wasted anyway. Rich people buy more food than poor people in absolute terms. A lot of it's imported. We have a colossal balance of payments problem. You know, I think there used to be a bit of concern about the government's budget deficit, you know, but that seems to have receded into the ether. But, you know, so on the other hand, you know, as I reminded Paul Johnson, when the ANC first got elected in the first democratic elections in South Africa and they reduced their political program, you know, bearing in mind they had to abolish apartheid and do all that kind of thing, to 6 points, one of them was the abolition of VAT on food, which they said was an absolute outrage. So, you know, there definitely are things that are considered politically just no-go areas. But I think the trouble is where we've got to now with, you know, this debate about the triple lock is there are just too many of them. So when Vanessa says, and I kind of sympathise with her view actually, that she doesn't quite believe, you know, that the government will mend its ways and be more consultative and look at more options, you think, well, I know what you mean, but actually the country is going to become completely ungovernable as regards tax if we carry on, you know, on our current way, because just too many things are boxed in. It's not, you know, it's 1 or 2% on national insurance is politically unacceptable in the same way that VAT on food is. What is there actually that is politically acceptable that is left? So I begin to think the government will run out of alternatives to raising some of these big issues. And I think people would find it easier to engage, actually, about some of those large issues than about some of the kind of more arcane technicalities that do feature in, have featured in most recent budgets.
Thank you.